and welcome to this special bonus episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. Now, during our coverage of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., we've had an opportunity to speak to key creatives involved in the show, and one that our listeners have been very keen for us to speak to, and who we are happy to say has generously agreed to join us today, is actor Joel Stouffer, who has brought great humour and humanity to the character of Enoch from season 4 through 7 of the show. Thank you so much for joining us today, Joel.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
That's our pleasure. But let's start at the beginning. I'm always curious to know what sort of lit the spark for the creatives that we speak to on the show. I'm just wondering, was creativity something that was encouraged in your childhood? Is it something that you were around?
Well, yeah, sure. It certainly wasn't discouraged. I mean, you know, my parents, you know, both of them were artists. I had, sort of free range to kind of pursue things that interested me, and they were supportive, you know, of that. So I certainly caught that bug when I was young, and have always dabbled in you know, several different areas of the arts as much as I could. Yeah, for sure.
And you mentioned the bug. What lit it up for you? What gave you that bug? What sort of, how did it manifest itself?
That's, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think I just sort of, you know, because like I said, both my parents, you know, my dad was a graphic artist, but also just a very talented artist. And my mom, you know, he had a business doing graphic arts, which was great. And my mom was a phenomenal artist, and just as a hobby more than anything. And I think I experimented with, like, you know, drawing and painting and discovered that I had a talent for it. And I think, you know, that was the same thing with acting as well. And I, from a young age, I think it's like, you know, you try something that for some reason interests you, and then, you know, something clicks that sort of compels you to keep pushing it. And you know, whether it's the reaction that you get from people who watch you do it, or just a feeling that you have that just keeps driving you. I mean, both of those things, I think, played a factor. And I just wanted to explore it as much as possible. I think, you know, I did a play when I was, you know, in grammar school, and I, you know, just being up on stage and playing Huck Finn or, you know, whatever. I think, you know, that experience was enough to kind of light a fire for me.
Have you done quite a lot of theater, or?
That's certainly where it started out for me. And that, cause that, expanded into, middle school and high school, doing theater throughout, always on doing a stage play. And then, in college, you know, of course, theater arts was my major. So, you know, always theater. I came back to LA after college and continued that, doing theater. And then I got involved in a theater group that I was with for about 15 years. And, you know, always just acting in or producing or directing, or, you know, I was designing sets and building them, you know, just always part of
that. That's amazing. Process. Yeah. Like a really holistic approach to performing.
Yes, mm-hmm. Which I think, you know, it just feeds, you know, the whole, all aspects of, you know, whatever my desire for that craving, you know,
yeah,
was. Yeah.
I think when you're kind of, I guess, obsessed with something, you want to be in every part of it. I used to competitively dance, and I was the same. I wanted to teach it and all of that kind of thing as well. You want to get right into it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's true for most people. I mean, I think that's what drives us, is what keeps us going and exploring.
I think that's what defines a successful actor over someone who looks at it as a job.
In my
opinion.
I think so. I think you want the passion to be there on all levels, because that really does, it just informs you and you know, makes you that much more attentive to pursuing a career from, you know, all different vantage points. That yeah. makes a difference.
I guess the other thing as well, and I think this is maybe where something like, you know, dancing and acting have in common, is the social element, of course, as well. And I'm just curious, Joel, was part of the appeal for you, perhaps, was it the sense of community, the sense of being part of something, or was it purely the craft of it?
Both, for sure. I think, you know, you get involved in something with like-minded people, and that also drives you, and you know, you celebrate, you know, milestones along the way together, and you know, you push each other, and certainly that helps to form the craft and you know, make it that much better. I think, you know, sometimes acting can be a sort of solitary you know, work, because you do have to kind of get inside somebody, and you're experiencing it in a very deeply personal way. And I think a lot of times for me, I know, like if I'm working on a character or whatever, I need alone time, you know, and I'm sure this probably is true in a lot of fields, a lot of different fields, but I need that time by myself to really get as in touch with whatever I need to get in touch with for the character by myself, so that then I have that confidence when I get to be with other people and work with other people, you know, performing in whatever scene, I have more freedom, you know, but I need that alone time first. So it's definitely a combination.
How do you manage that as a parent?
That's a good question.
I'm looking for tips, basically. We're all craving for that work-life balance. If you've got anything, Joel, I'm not more late, buddy.
Oh man, it's not easy, as you know. My wife and I didn't have Hugo. I was 46, I think, when he was born. So, you know, and he's 10 now. So I was already kind of set in, you know, my ways, and a lot of, you know, there's downsides and upsides to having a kid when you're older, but
well, we did the same. So we're right there with you. I was in my 40s.
It's such a big change, a welcome change, but definitely takes some getting used to, and being willing to set aside, you know, whatever practices I may have grown accustomed to in the past, so that I could be with my son as much as possible. I mean, I try to really make time for him whenever I can. It's very hard sometimes if I'm working on something and he walks in and he's like, I need to wrestle right now, or I need to play. You know, he just got these like Star Wars lightsabers, and like he's wanting to always engage and do something. And sometimes I have to say, can't right now. I'm working, and I have to, you know, and then sometimes
I'm meeting with the producers of Stranger Things at the moment, I'm afraid.
Yeah, right. Something like that. If I'm on a call or something, it's like, yeah, it'd be really hard. But and then sometimes I can just sort of like take a breath and realize that whatever I'm doing right now, I can still do in a half an hour. I can get back to it. I give a half an hour or whatever. You know, to play and make that connection, you know, with him, it's so important. You have to be able to do that. That the connection is everything. And when he's asking, he's saying, I want to connect. It may sometimes sound like or feel like he's intentionally interrupting me just to make me mad. And sometimes it feels like, what are you, you're doing this now? You see I'm busy. What are you talking about? But really, you know, he may be aware that he's kind of doing it, you know, just to get me a little riled to see if I'll, you know, pay attention to him.
Yeah.
But ultimately, he still wants that connection, and he's asked for that connection. And I'm like, I got it.
And one day he will stop asking for that connection.
Yeah. So that's exactly right. So you know, take advantage of the time now while you can, because one day he's going to be like, I got to go be with my friend. Interested in being with my parents.
Right. And it'll be you interrupting him saying, please, can we play with the lightsabers?
Totally.
Well, by that point, though, he'll be old enough for you to sort of cash in a little bit of that Stranger Things cachet. Maybe he'll come back around at that point.
Yeah,
that's already gotten me a lot of points. The Stranger Things game, because he has friends. He hasn't watched it yet. He's not quite old enough yet, but he has friends at school. You know, they've watched it and they talk about it, and you know, they know Hugo's dad is in the show, and like, you know, so I've got some fans, and Hugo.
Amazing.
That's some great capital to have. I mean, we mentioned, you know, I don't think that you and I are too far off each other in age, but of course you came up with the great films of the 70s. You know, I mean, arguably one of the greatest decades of cinema. And what was it about that decade, do you think, as a viewer and now, of course, as an actor, that was so special?
It's a great question. I can't quite put a finger on it. It just, you know, cinema had been through enough, you know, transitions and evolutions in the prior, you know, 50 years, I guess, that by the time the 70s came around, you know, after the sort of, you know, the explosion of emotion, I think, that came out of the 60s, you know, there was 60s was such an upheaval. And I think by the time cinema kind of caught up to that, they were more willing to take a deeper dive into things and do things that you know hadn't been done before and feel confident that there was an audience for it. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's part of what compelled some of the greats from that, you know, era, you know, Coppola and Spielberg and, you know, Cimino and Scorsese. I mean, those guys were really like saying, let's go dark, let's do really dark stuff, or let's do big, scary, you know, blockbuster things that you know, but in a way that we hadn't seen before. I mean, it was it was really it was kind of like a no holds bar era. And I like you said, I mean, I grew up in it, and I had this thing. There was this cable box that you could get that attached to your TV with a cord, and it had like a row of like 13 buttons on it, and the first button was the Z channel. And the Z channel, like, you press the Z channel, and at certain times of the day during the week, you could watch a scheduled movie on your TV. And, you know, it was the 70s, so like, my dad was, I don't know, he was paying X number of dollars a month for this. And, you know, a new movie would come out every week, and or a few movies. And I was watching like Mean Streets and, you know, movies that were totally inappropriate for a child.
Were these the TV cuts of the movies, or were these the theatrical?
No, these were theatrical versions. They were like, they were unedited. They were the full versions.
And how old were you then?
So I think I was like 7 when we got
Wow,
you saw Mean Streets at 7. That's some pretty transgressive cinema there.
Yes, and like A Clockwork Orange. And,
oh, Jesus.
And, you know, all these movies that came out and you know, that, but, you know, I had, you know, the freedom because my parents, you know, they were, it was this, I just chalk it up to being in, it was the 70s.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily excuse it, but.
Oh yeah. We hand wave a lot under that, don't we?
Yeah.
My daughter often says to me, oh, were you allowed to do that because it was the 80s, Mum? Yep, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So I think you're mixing the 80s up with the 60s, darling, when it comes to...
It was just a different time. And obviously, like, we know, my wife is a parent educator. She coaches parents. And so, you know, she reads so much about like the studies that are done now that have been done in the last 20 years or so. And, you know, what we know now about how things affect kids and their brain development from a young age, there's certain things like, no, you cannot watch that until you are X, you know, number of years old.
You'll end up being an actor if you watch Clockwork Orange. Exactly. So, you know,
God forbid.
There's a cautionary tale.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I obviously, you know, you have to find a balance, and we certainly don't prohibit things for my son. I mean, he watches a lot of stuff, and it's just that we kind of do it in increments and stages, so that and we talk about it. And like, if he sees something that's really traumatic for him, we find ways for him to express that. And I mean, so we're always making that connection. It's always a
learning curve with what they watch and stuff. We're the same with our two. We'll come up with these rules of, we're only going to watch 20 minutes of this, and we'll right. do this, and da da da. And then, that's ever evolving and ever changing depending on.
There's a difference, and it sounds like this was the case for you, Joel, a little bit. I think that if they've actually got an interest in the craft itself,
yeah,
I think that's slightly different then as well, because you can yes. then discuss the mechanics of that somewhat.
Absolutely. Our daughter's very into making little movies and stuff, and she's desperate for a YouTube channel and all this kind of thing. And we're like, hard pass on, hey guys, welcome to my channel. Like, yeah, subscribe. Yeah.
That's a fun thing to traverse. I mean, Hannah brought up theatre earlier on, Joel. I'm just curious. I don't know what your sort of recent experience has been in this area, but do you feel, are there any similarities or like key similarities or differences between playing a character in an ongoing sense on a TV show and playing a character for an ongoing theatrical engagement where the text is static? Are they very different, those different ways of spending time with a character?
I think well, with theater, it feels like I'm more interested in creating the big picture visually, in terms of what the audience sees and how that plays out and how that relates to whatever character choices I make. In terms of like the development of the character, I think I still have the same process, whether it's film or theater. But with film, you can get so much more specific. Theater has to be a little bit bigger and a little bit, not necessarily, I don't want to say broader, because you still want specifics and nuances. I mean, I was doing theater for like 50-seat house, which is different than doing theater for a 2,000-seat house. I mean, it's they're just different venues, but with film, you can focus more on really detailed, specific moments of a scene, and without telegraphing it, you can find your way into certain moments so that it's still real, but at the same time you're playing it for the camera from a certain angle, and so. Yeah, you just have to find that as organically as you can.
Do you find that your style of performance is much subtler on TV as opposed to theatre, because the camera is like much more focused on you? And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, especially now, I think, so much of what is done on TV film, I mean, it's subtlety of movement. You have to really be aware of how much you're moving your body, if your head's bouncing around, and stillness is really key most of the time. I mean, there obviously times characters that I've done where movement is a real part of it, and so you have to find a place to make that work, but stillness, subtlety, I mean, that all plays on stage as well, but it's just it's different when your volume has to adapt to make sure that everybody can hear you. Mm. Whereas on film, you can speak softly.
We talked about this on the podcast, didn't we? Because one of the things that we noticed about your performance style, and our listeners have mentioned this as well, is that you're probably going to embarrass you a little bit here, but you're a wonderful sort of open-faced actor, I feel. In the sense that you can really see what you're thinking in the performance. And that can be, a movement of an eyebrow or a blink. I'm just wondering, how do you calibrate that? How do you modulate size when it comes to that kind of facial acting? Is it a simple case of learning that if you're thinking something, it finds its way out on your face? Or is there a mechanical element to that from a performance perspective?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think it's being, you know, training yourself over years to be as open and free with your emotions and your expression of that emotion as you can be. And then it's like, you know, so you practice when you're training to like have a super big, you know, overblown emotion. And then as long as it's real, and then, you know, that gets refined as well over the years to where you can still have that emotion, but trust that it's coming through your face in a subtler way, a smaller way.
It's one of the most fantastic things about your performance as Enoch is like I sort of felt like once you'd read that part, you had in your head exactly how to get kind of sympathy and humor and a sense of purpose across in the very tiniest of movements. Like sometimes you're barely moving your body, but you're conveying so much in it.
It's a real high definition performance.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's so, you should be so, I mean, you know, what am I to say? You should be so proud of yourself. Well done.
Thank you. I mean, I am. I wish I could say that it was all, you know, like perfectly crafted every second of the way. I mean, I think that, you know, you just, all you can do is just make choices and hope that they're working. And you know, you're mostly just winging it when you, yeah. You know, you script, you don't have a lot of time to repair. You get on set and you got to make a choice. And so you make a choice and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I look back on some of the stuff that I did as Enoch and I'm like, oh, could have done a different choice there.
Is that partially though, because of the way that the character evolved through that symbiotic relationship between you and the writers? Is it maybe just when you look back at perhaps some of the earlier episodes where the character's development hadn't been fully formed or realized?
Absolutely.
And yeah. Is there a hindsight element to that, I'm guessing?
Oh, sure. I mean, the writers, you know, we've talked about this many times because, you know, they didn't really know who Enoch was. They just thought, oh, well, maybe we'll make room for this character and we'll see where it goes. If we get an actor that can, you know, find a way into whoever this person is and we like it, then we'll continue it. And I mean, they were fully prepared to like nix the role if they didn't get the right actor for the role that didn't inspire them. And luckily that symbiosis happened and we kind of fed each other and didn't really know exactly where it was going to go at any given moment. I think they just, I think by like, you know, season six, you know, cause I came in at the end of season four and then we had season five. And I think by like season six, they were like, oh, okay, you know, now we know who this guy is and we know how we're going to write for this guy and like how to push the envelope just enough, push the edge a little bit, see what Enoch can do and, you know, take a chance on Joel and see if he can make some choices that work. And luckily it worked out. But yeah, it was definitely a work in progress most of the time.
Just in terms of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and how you came to be Enoch. Was it just a standard auditioning process or had you been approached about Marvel stuff or know a lot about the universe before you auditioned?
I didn't. The way it came about was I had auditioned for a couple of other roles prior on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And enough to where I think that the casting director got, I'm assuming this, the casting director must have gotten enough feedback from producers, positive feedback. And this role came up, I think maybe last minute. I don't know exactly how much time they gave it at the end of season four. Mm-hmm. And I think they just said to the casting director, send us some tapes of some actors and we'll see if we can find somebody that's going to work for this role. And you know, we'll just put him in at the end of this last episode on season four. And so they sent a bunch of the casting sent a bunch of tapes. And like Jeff Bell told me, it was like, they watched a bunch of tapes and they thought, and they saw mine and they were like, that's the guy.
Yeah.
And so it was literally that random. I mean, yeah. It was like, they could have so easily on a different day said, no, maybe somebody else. I mean, it was like that. It felt
It sounds like Tinder.
It's kind of like, it's
they have an app that they use for this.
Yeah. That's really true.
Both a professional and a social level, what's it like sort of plugging into a pre-established show with the ensemble and the crew and the production line element, particularly with these network shows that do, you know, these large order seasons? How does that feel on that first day when you're kind of walking into this just maelstrom?
It's always a little off-putting, a little nerve-wracking. I mean, you want to feel like you're a part of it, and at the same time, you don't want to step on anybody's toes. You know, people that have been doing it for a long time, they're just trying to do their jobs, like you said, I mean, they have a way of working together, and you you spend the first, well, like, so if you're lucky, you get multiple episodes on a show so that you can have the experience of learning what it's like to eventually become a part of the show. You know, if you're just coming in for one episode, it's different. I mean, what I found is that the best shows, and I've been very lucky because I haven't really had any bad experiences on shows. Some of it been better than others, but nothing like, I've heard some horror stories from some actors.
Sure.
But for me, you just kind of have to suss it out, and you keep an open mind, and you have to know your job before you get there, and be as confident as you can be going in, so that, like, you know, once you're on set and the camera's rolling, you do what they need you to do. And then they like you. And then they can decide if they want to bring you back for more, or if it's just a one-time thing, they say goodbye. And, you know, like, it's an interesting process. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was for me, you know, the first time that I've done that many episodes on a show. And it was a fantastic experience, because I felt welcomed from day one. I had conversations with, like, some of the lead actors on the show that made me feel like I was already a part of the group in a way. And this is before anybody knew where Enoch was going to go on the show. They didn't have any agenda. You know, it was just, they had just very open arms. It was really great. And that continued through to the very end. And I got to feel like what it was like to be a part of that family on a show. It was great.
It does from all the conversations we've had, and we've talked to Craig Titley and Stan Brooks and Gabe Luna. It's very much, everybody has said what a familial feeling it was.
The show's run by a family.
And very encouraging and bring you into the fold. And that's pretty amazing.
Yes. And I've maintained contact with some people from the show, and Craig Titley and I have gotten together for, you know, dinner and drinks, and we still talk about, you know, how just special it was.
Yeah.
It really was.
Are you part of the cigar club?
I have been invited a couple of times, but it hasn't happened yet.
I want in on the cigar club. I mean, we have a bit of a commute, but
just fly over for it. No problem.
Hop in your jet. No, I'm not a big cigar smoker, but I want to go just to see what that's all about.
Just rock up with some kind of placebo. We actually, one of our listeners, Jack Dubs, has fired us some questions for you. And this seems like the point to do it now. I think we've probably covered off the first one, haven't we?
Yes, just through the organic.
But one of the remaining questions is, How do you feel when you saw the script for the season 5 premiere and realized that you would have such a large chunk of the first act to yourself?
That's great. This is a story that I tell because when I, you know, when I first did it in at the end of season 4, they were like, you know, if we get picked up for season 5, we might have you back for a couple of episodes. We'll see. And so I was waiting, you know, to see if it gets picked up, and I, you know, it does. And then eventually they send me a script for, you know, that first episode, and I'm reading it, and they hadn't told me anything about, you know, my character at this point. Like, I didn't know what I was. I didn't know anything. I just started reading the episode, and it's that amazing 5-page intro of this character who's like, you know, getting ready, and he goes for a swim, and he's meditating in the bottom of the pool, and heads are playing over it. And I'm like, what an amazing like opportunity for an actor to get to play this. How cool. I wonder who that character is. Who's it going to be? And the character's name was Silas at the time.
Oh, right.
This is a little info.
I can see that. You look like a Silas.
Yes. Yes. Before we ended up shooting, they changed the name, obviously, but I got through that scene, and I was like, okay, so, you know, I've kept reading, and I'm like, I don't see, there's no, who could I be in this episode? And it finally dawned on me, I think I'm Silas. And then, you know, sure enough, that was the deal. And then they changed the name to Enoch, and I went and shot it, and it was a blast. It was just, you know, a great, like I said, it was a great opportunity to get to kind of, you know, play around with those first 5 minutes.
I wonder if they thought his name was too close to Cassius.
Yeah, because another character.
Going into season 5.
Very possibly, yes.
And I think it's interesting as well that you mentioned that, because I think that Enoch exists in that great tradition of characters that have taken on a life of their own. You know, I think of like the cigarette smoking man in the X-Files, yeah. You know, these characters who were on the periphery. And I think that the key thing with Enoch is definitely, and this jumps out rewatching the show now for the podcast, is there comes a point where clearly the writers had a real Rosetta Stone moment of how to deploy the character, like how to use Enoch in the storyline. And one other question we've got from one of our listeners here is, this is again from Jack, is, have you got any favorite moments from the show? I don't know whether Jack means sort of on-screen moments or behind the scenes, but when you look back at that experience, are there any moments that really stand out to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few that I think were, you know, that stuck with me for sure. I would say, I don't know. The show's already out, so I'm not worried about spoilers, right?
Oh yeah, no, don't worry about that. That's fine.
maybe spoiler alerts for audiences who are watching along with us for the first time, because we're still in season 6. But skip forward a couple of minutes in case there's any season 7.
But we've watched it all, obviously. That's why it's a rewatch for us. So yeah, no, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say for the death scene in season 5 at the for me was a big one. Yeah. That one really stuck with me, but then getting to come back the way they set it up, you know, that an alternate timeline, you know, with Enoch and Fitz in season 6 was really fun. There was, you know, episode 603, Craig and Brent wrote that one, and getting to play as much as I did throughout that episode, they you know, they really handed me a lot to do, and it was.
Is that when you were gambling?
Yes, gambling and you know, having the existential crisis, and
I love like, that.
You know, that was like, you know, they, you know, they it was written on the page that way, and they were like, you know, let's see what comes out of it, and you know, again, you make choices, and you know, Jesse Bochco and I were really meshing on that episode, and we were, you know,
we seemed to be in sync. And so some of the stuff that, that came out, I think it was a really fun experience, a fun process.
And that was the point, I think, where the audience realized how much the Levinok, because I think that there was a real sense of how happy people were to see the character return.
Yeah.
So that felt like a solidification in the minds of the audience about how great the character is. And you were talking about how defining the character in 603. And I've got to ask, was Leonard Nimoy an influence on your any of your performance choices?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say Leonard Nimoy, Brent Spiner. I mean, you know, from Star Trek, I mean, those guys kind of set the tone in a lot of ways. Obviously, I mean, Spock is you know, iconic. And I didn't consciously, you know, I wasn't consciously like aware of being, you know, emulating them in any way, but I certainly on some level, you know, once I learned who this guy was and that he was, this, you know, Chronicom, but somehow organic as well.
Yeah.
like there had to be this blend of robot and human, and so I think what came out was certainly inspired by those guys.
And I certainly don't
get a lot of a Fringe vibe as well from your performance with, I don't know if you've seen Fringe, but
I haven't.
There's a group of people called the Observers, who are very, like, they're human but they're very right. advanced, and yeah, they have the same kind of very quiet, but
yeah
really subtle but interesting performances.
To the characters. Yeah. I think as well, I certainly don't mean to be you know, reductive in any way, but I think also, I guess, you have a slight physical similarity to Nimoy in some ways. And I think perhaps the baritone voice as well. You've got a question here, Hannah, about the physicality of the character. I think.
Oh yes. How did you cope with fight scenes, like fighting Ming-Na Wen? Was it like, did you find that hard in terms of staying in Enoch's character? And
I mean, a little bit, I think. Because they also, you know, the script indicates that Enoch has the upgrade, you know,
yeah.
So because he wasn't necessarily a fighter before.
Yeah.
And so now all of a sudden he has the data input to,
have you done a lot of fighting, acting, like combat?
Not a lot. Some little bit of stunt work that kind of comes with the territory over the years, but not too much. I just don't have the ability to lift my leg that high. So they had to have, you know, a stunt double that was phenomenal, and he was able to do so much of it. But I tried to do as much of it as I could, you know, I'm gonna get out of sight. So, but yeah, it was really just about, you know, the same kind of thing, keeping it contained but still like fierce and determined and you know, I think it wasn't too much of a break or anything from who Enoch was.
Yeah.
Well, another thing as well that jumped out on this rewatch, I'm just curious to know how you managed this and how much of a challenge it was, and this is particularly the case for 709. You know, a very big episode, and also, you know, probably I think often generally regarded as the best episode of the show. I think it's the highest rated episode on IMDb. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if you can speak a little bit to the process and the experience of playing scenes where your character, and I'm thinking obviously of the climax of 709, scenes where your character is the emotional center of the scene, but you're unable to emote, at least in the conventional sense, but your colleagues are around you. Is that a challenge? How does that work?
It was a little bit for me, but I think, you know, what partly worked is that I had, you know, three seasons to kind of get to a place where, you know, I just trusted the character and the choices enough. I think, you know, one thing was, like, I even said this to Elizabeth when we were shooting, I was like, this is an emotional scene, and I'm just going to be crying because it's like, you know, my last big episode on an epic run for me personally on this show, and we're winding down on the show, and like all these emotions come up just as a human. And I said to her, like, you know, Enoch is a Chronicom. He's not going to have tears. If I'm crying and you see tears, like, how is that going to work? And Elizabeth, who was fantastic as a director and fantastic, you know, her performance, of course, as Simmons is amazing. But and she just says, don't worry about it. You know, she was just like, don't worry about it. And so then, like, what it was for me was just about keeping still, as Enoch would, and just let whatever emotions come up, just come up. And so it was really, I just didn't really think about it too much. I mean, that's ultimately the key, is you know, you always say you have to process some things, in a cerebral way, like, you know, to a degree, and then you just kind of throw that out the door and try to forget about it so that you're not stuck in your thoughts. And so, you know, I it was just a matter of, you know, committing to that and then just letting whatever happened. And you know,
yeah.
So anyway, yeah, that was that being the other incredibly memorable moment for me, in the overall arc of the character.
How did you find working with Ian? Cause you would have probably worked with him the closest, did you?
Yeah. And it was great. It was really, really fun. He's a wonderful guy. And I was just, you know, I was bummed when he didn't come back for season 7 because I was so looking forward to
it. Yeah, having him there in 709 would have been great, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and the writers did such an amazing job of having, you know, the presence of Fitz, you know, in that season, and then of course Ian did come back for the last few episodes, but they wrote him in a way that you still felt his presence, and you know, so but yeah, as far as working with Ian, it was great. We hit it off right away from day
one.
You
guys had such a natural chemistry between you both on the screen, that I figured it wasn't just acting, like you obviously got on with each other. And
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't anyone that on that show that I didn't get on with. I mean, they were such a great group, you know.
Yeah.
But certainly Ian and I bonded in a pretty special way. We had a lot of days working together, so that was great.
Yeah. Oh, well, you're best friends, you know. You said that's great.
Besties.
Well, that's one question I was wondering about. I mean, because obviously, you know, Stranger Things as well, you know, you see clearly something now that you're very well known for. And I'm just wondering, so you've worked on both network shows and streaming shows. What was the difference between those from a production perspective, do you feel? Because it feels very much like we are in a phase of transition in the business between the size and the scope and the the way that television works. And you've got a pretty
good perspective. Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, probably depends. Netflix, Stranger Things was my first streaming show that I got to be on, and I just I don't know that this would be true on all streaming studios, but for Netflix, they, you know, it being their top show, they poured so much money into it that allowed them to really make it, each episode had a more filmic vibe because they could take so much time. You know, they could take the time to set up these, you know, very sort of epic sweeping shots and cranes and, you know, all this stuff that added to that show immensely. And the experience as an actor, they didn't hold back much, which was great. So yeah, there wasn't a sense of like urgency. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, you know, you shoot an episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which they did phenomenally within like an 8-day shoot schedule. Mm. Like 8 days, the show, that episode is wrapped. Stranger Things, they were essentially giving about 40 days to each episode.
Wow.
They're not throwing that track in front of the train quite as much as they might be on a network show.
So there wasn't that sense of urgency and I think therefore less stress. I mean, I'm sure everybody still was feeling stressed, but I think less stress for sure. Mm. And they were able to take their time in that way. That was the biggest change from one to the other. And I don't know if that's true on Amazon or, any of the others, but...
Mm.
Yeah.
Just a kind of a random question from me. What are your nostalgia watches or your comfort watches that you have?
Because we started doing our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. rewatch during the pandemic. A lot of people, we just wanted to watch things that brought us comfort. We didn't want to be challenged.
And we'd just finished, we got to the end of season 7, and I said to Mike, I'd love to go back to season 1 and just see how different it is watching it again, seeing that, knowing what happens to all of the characters, having a look at the evolution of that and experiencing it in a different way. And it's been an absolute joy to watch it again, knowing what's coming, just to relax into it and watch it. Do you have anything like that that you go to when you're needing some comfort?
I wish that I could say yes. I don't watch that much. I mean, I watch, we watched stuff, try to watch it stuff together that my son can watch,
Yeah.
So, but I'm, my son got really into Harry Potter.
Oh yeah.
And so
our daughter's very into Harry Potter.
Yeah. We read all the books. And then after we would finish a book, we would watch the movie for each book, and we would watch each movie 3 or 4 times pretty much. And we really, really did a deep dive into Harry Potter, but that was fun. And I would say that absolutely, certainly, because that happened over the pandemic, and that became really comforting, choosing to commit, emotionally to the characters and their plight and, their arc and all of that, and talking about
the world
and the world of magic that was created. I mean, that was a lot of fun. And I would say that has become kind of a, a familiar comfort source for us.
We'll have to look out for the Joel Stopher Harry Potter podcast.
Yeah,
it sounds like you could probably do a dissertation on the franchise.
We are now on to Harry Potter Trivial Pursuit, which no matter how many times I read the books or watch the movies, I still suck at. Yeah. I can't seem to get.
Well, there's so many names and so many things.
So many details. My son, however, 10 years old. Kicks
encyclopedic, I'm sure.
Yeah, just like every answer, he's like, "Oh yeah, okay. What else you got?"
the minds of youth. Very, very conscious of your time. So, just got a couple of super quick questions. The one thing that my 10-year-old self would be kicking me if I didn't mention it is, you were in a frigging Indiana Jones film, Joel. you acted with Harrison Ford, directed by Stevens. I mean, that's like acting with Rick from Casablanca. What was that experience like, and how did it come about?
I'm still kind of pinching myself every time I think about that, because, I'd grown up with a friend of mine whose dad and mom and a best friend of theirs were friends with Harrison Ford in the 60s. And, they had lost touch, but I remember them telling stories about Harrison Ford, and he was doing carpentry at the time and, did some work on their house for them. And, and thinking what a cool, pre-life he had before his, before his acting career kicked in. And so I without any, without thinking about it, it was not in any way tying it to Harrison Ford, but I became interested in woodworking and started doing carpentry. And I was like starting to design and build kitchens. And I, you know, because acting, you know, I'm still a struggling actor most of the time. So you got to do something to pay the bills. So I design and build kitchens. I haven't for a while, but I used to. And so I just, you know, having that in common with him and then being such a fan of his work and then Steven Spielberg, you know, like getting on that set in that room, being directed by, you know, Spielberg and working across the table from, you know, Harrison Ford, it was kind of surreal for me. It really was.
And, yeah, I don't even know how you process that.
I feel like I was able to rise above it, but I don't know. I don't know that I felt as free to just, you know, be whoever I was supposed to be and make the choices I was supposed to make. I had a little bit more of a self-awareness than I should have had while we were shooting that. I think it worked and it was fine, but it was a really fantastic and reaffirming experience for me. It was like, okay, I'm pinching myself. It's surreal. But at the same time, I was like, just kind of soaking it in that this is where I belong. This is the level that I want to be working at. And here I am doing it, you know? It was great. It was a great experience.
Yeah, that's one for dinner parties, isn't it? I think, you know, if people are like, how's the acting going? You're like, well, just pull this little nugget out of my back pocket and whack it down on the table.
Yes.
But go on.
No, I was just saying, I have to remind myself of it every time that I'm not getting a job.
Right. I'm like, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I didn't get that job, but did you see what I did 15 years ago?
There you go. Last but not least, I mean, obviously, you know, we are calling you from the future, as we said earlier on, and Enoch obviously got involved in a little bit of the timey-wimey. Mm-hmm. If you could travel back in time and speak to your younger self, what would you say to them? What advice would you give them? Or would you just get the hell out of the way?
Oh, man. A little bit of both there. I would say trust yourself more. Find a way into your confidence more in terms of, you know, that you are in the right place and making choices as an actor and I would also say do more, you know, to try to expand on the work and give yourself more opportunities and reach out to people more, pursue opportunities more. All of those things I think would be pretty critical.
That you study Harry Potter.
Yeah. 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 Those would be the big things. That's not to say that I didn't do those things. I certainly did. But I, you know, you realize now, like looking back, there's a moment where I could have done this, a moment I could have done this. And so trusting more and trying harder are two things I would say I would tell myself. Yeah.
I'd just be scared that I'd tread on the wrong butterfly and my children wouldn't be born. So I'd be very, 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 very cool. Thank you so much for your time, John. It's been a real thrill.
Of course. Yeah.
And when we were doing the show, like I say, we say this with absolute sincerity that you were definitely one that our audience wanted us to reach out to. So from us and from them, we'd just like to thank you so much.
We are so grateful. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
All the best.
Take care.
You have a great day.
Yeah, you guys too. Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. See you later. Bye.
Right.